5 News.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. Later in the broadcast, Tech Tuesday explores the final frontier of outer space and whether robots should replace humans in exploring the cosmos. But before we head to outer space, we explore the most disturbing corners of cyberspace, namely the corners where child pornography thrives. It's been a problem on the Internet almost since the Internet was created, and cracking down on the people who distribute and view child porn can be a daunting challenge. Now, prosecutors are trying a new strategy, reaching out to Internet service providers, companies like Sprint and Verizon. Earlier this month, the New York Attorney General reached an agreement with several of those providers to restrict access to sites that disseminate child porn. It's a policy that's getting a lot of praise, but also raising a lot of questions, namely about whether there's a slippery slope in giving big companies the power and responsibility to police content on the Internet. Joining us by telephone from Alexandria, Virginia, is John Sheehan, Director of Exploited Children Services, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. John Sheehan, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us by phone from Basking Ridge, New Jersey, is Eric Rabe, Senior Vice President for Media Relations with Verizon. Eric Rabe, good to have you aboard.
Good to be with you.
In our studio is John Morris, General Counsel and Director of the Internet Standards, Technology and Policy Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. John, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Kojo. Thanks.
Eric Rabe, allow me to start with you. There's been some confusion about this new policy. Some reports have suggested that Verizon and the other companies are going to block child porn found both on regular websites and on the newsgroup sites that have operated on the Internet for decades. Other reports have suggested that the policy only affects the newsgroups. Can you explain that new policy to us?
Well, let me see if I can be clear about this, and thanks for giving me the chance, because I agree with you, there's been a good deal of confusion about
this. Yes, we need some demystification here.
Let's demystify then. Let's take this one piece at a time. In the case of websites, now we're talking about, the websites that we're all familiar with that we all use a million times a day. Verizon has agreed, and actually this predates the Attorney General's investigation, or our awareness of it at any rate, that you mentioned earlier. Verizon has agreed with a national organization to use a list that they provide regularly of websites that they've identified that contain child pornography. What we will do is examine this list and determine if any of the websites identified there are websites in the Verizon network, so websites hosted on our servers or websites hosted by customers of ours who may be using their own computers to do that. If we find that to be the case, we will take those websites down. We do this under our terms of service agreement with our customers. They are not permitted under our terms of service to put child pornography on our servers or use our systems as a way to exchange child pornography, and so we think we're on very solid ground there. If we see websites on this list, and we always do, that are not on the Verizon network, we take no action regarding those sites at all. So that's what happens regarding websites.
Well, so that what I've read, that Verizon is planning to stop offering customers access to a broad range of different news groups, including many where it's extremely unlikely for child porn to exist, is probably not accurate, or is it?
Well, no. This is part two. as regards the news groups, then, distinct from the websites
yes.
I was talking about, what we will do is offer to news group subscribers of Verizon Online, our Internet site, our Internet service, rather, we will offer them the what are known as the Big Eight hierarchies. These are news groups that begin with designators like SCI or REC, and have to do with scientific subjects, recreational topics, and a variety of others. We will not offer access through our service to other news groups. This is distinct from what some companies have done, which is to eliminate the news groups altogether. Now, customers who want to reach those other news groups, including the ones that begin with ALT, that's available to them. There are a number of commercial services that offer this access at no charge, such as Google Groups, Yahoo has a similar service, and others. So, you know, customers who want to get to those sites can get to them. And indeed, there are commercial services that do charge for access to these news groups that will get you to any news group you want to go to. The reason we made the distinction that we did make was because, first of all, we want to be able to clearly communicate to customers what it was that we're offering and what we're not offering. And secondly, the New York Attorney General, in an investigation that continues, but which has been going on for 8 months, determined that news groups in the alt hierarchies, because they are generally not moderated, are places that are hospitable to child pornography, and indeed where child pornography exists in a number of cases, and they were able to identify some news groups in the alt hierarchy that did that. We felt the cleanest and easiest way for us to respond to this was to make this change that I've described. But I want to emphasize there's no blocking going on here. So if a Verizon Online customer wishes to reach those alt news groups, they can do so. They just can't do it through the Verizon News Group reader service.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on fighting child pornography on the Internet. If you'd like to join it, you can call 800-433-8850. Do you think Internet service providers should be involved in cracking down on child porn on the web? You can call us at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. John Sheehan, your organization is helping the Internet service providers to identify potentially troubling material. The impression I got was that most child pornography is coming into this country from other parts of the world, and that that's why it's been so difficult to prosecute the people who disseminate it and view it. Is that accurate?
Well, it's absolutely a challenging endeavor that we're undertaking, and having the support of industry and law enforcement, as well as lawmakers involved in this, it's crucial. When you talk to the international community, they're actually going to point back that a lot of content is being hosted in the U.S. Now, is it on the backbone of the Internet, or is it on some of the small providers? When you're looking at the U.S. as a whole, there are over 5,000 electronic service providers in operation, and that's a lot of industry players that could be providing services or that could be exploited. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, we operate the Cyber Tip Line. It was launched back in March of 1998 through a congressional mandate to be the 911 of the Internet, essentially, when you're talking about child sexual exploitation. If you fast forward to today, since 1998, we've received over 600,000 tips into our Cyber Tip Line, cybertipline.com. What our staff do now, when we're talking about this URL list, our staff processes about 2,000 leads a week, and that's regarding all types of child sexual exploitation, but 90% of that volume is regarding child pornography. Our staff will access those websites, and when we're talking about this URL list, we're talking about the worst of the worst type of material. So my staff will access the content, we'll document it. If we find images of prepubescent children, so children in web pages, images, videos that show no obvious physical indicators of sexual maturation that would be consistent with an adult, it will go on to that list. There's a lot of images that we're not quite sure about. Those won't go on there. We are providing to industry free of charge what we see is a piece to the puzzle. This isn't a silver bullet. This isn't going to solve the problem. But if we can help to eliminate the exposure, the possibility of coming across these websites, making it harder to find, we view that really as a piece to the puzzle. And if you look at this internationally, you've got countries like Australia, Canada, Denmark, the UK, France just started the filtering and blocking initiatives as well. So in many ways, what we're doing programmatically, we're learning from other NGOs and other cyber tip lines across the world, and we're trying to implement and work with industry in the same type of initiatives.
John Morris, child pornography is not protected speech under the Constitution, and cracking down on it is a goal that pretty much everyone seems to be able to get behind. But you're still concerned about the constitutional aspects of this agreement. Can you elaborate?
Certainly, and certainly I completely agree that child pornography is horrific and that we all should work together to combat it. But having said that, it's important to do that within the context and the confines of our laws and our Constitution. And so as bad as this content is, we need to follow the law, follow the Constitution. I have really three separate concerns about what we've been discussing. One concern is the reported coercion that the New York Attorney General brought to bear against the ISPs in this situation, against Verizon, Sprint, and Time Warner. And the news reports suggest that the Attorney General made some very specific threats of charges. And so if that's true, and I honestly wasn't involved, obviously, so I don't know, but if that's true, then the New York Attorney General has achieved an end, the shutting down of these news groups, that he couldn't constitutionally achieve by direct action. So that's a very serious concern there.
Your other two?
The second concern is that the ISPs, I think, have really, frankly, overreacted. The Time Warner has shut down all news groups, and Verizon has shut down many of the news groups. Sprint has shut down many also. The ISPs have no obligation to provide news groups, to their customers. And so I don't dispute the company's right to decide what to carry and what not to carry. That's certainly appropriate. But in this case, the Attorney General identified 88 different news groups out of more than 100,000 news groups that are out there as being problematic. And the ISPs have cut out tens and tens and tens of thousands of news groups that are perfectly innocent, perfectly useful, news groups that relate to discussing politics in this country, news groups that relate to, a huge host of topics.
Your third concern?
Third concern is with the URL list that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children maintains. NCMEC is a private organization, and the companies are private companies, and so there's no constitutional concern if the private companies follow NCMEC's list. But if the URL list becomes part of a government mandate, either from the Attorney General in New York or from Congress through the SAFE Act, then, in fact, it becomes a constitutional problem. And what you have is you have a private organization following a government mandate and blocking access with no court involved, no judicial proceeding at all. So what they're doing now is fine, but it raises red flags for the future.
John Morris is General Counsel and Director of the Internet Standards at the Technology and Policy Project of the Center for Democracy and Technology. He joins us in our Washington studio. Eric Rabe joins us from New Jersey. He's Senior Vice President for Media Relations with Verizon. And John Sheehan is Director of Exploited Children Services at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. John Sheehan, I suspect you'd like to respond.
Oh, well, I think there's some very positive remarks there, and absolutely, we are treading very lightly. We're examining this the entire way through, and we understand the private-to-private type of communications and what could happen as part of being a governmental mandate, and right now, it's a completely voluntary effort. The URL list that we provide on a daily basis, right now, it's only going to a dozen plus electronic service providers, and I mentioned there are 5,000 out there, so there are many that aren't utilizing the availability, and we make it there. They can come in. We have an agreement where they can access it through an MOU. We are raising awareness that it's there, but it's certainly not a driving force. It's not something we're trying to push down anyone's throat in regarding industry and what we can do. We're really looking at this as a piece to the puzzle on what we can do to help eradicate sexually abusive images of children online, and there's no question that there's much more to this problem dealing with the internet as a whole, whether you're looking at news groups, peer-to-peer, URLs and websites, different chat rooms. There's a big piece to the puzzle, and where we can take chunks out, so be it.
Eric Rabe, I have a question for you, but allow me first to go to Greg in Herndon, Virginia, who also, I think, has a question for you. Greg, you go up first.
All right. So, yes, my question is for Eric. I'm a recent Verizon subscriber, and I thought his commentary on the mechanism which they would be using to throw off users that had the child pornography was interesting. He mentioned that it was because it was a violation of their terms of service. Now, when I got my service, I read the terms of service, and I didn't see a prohibition on child pornography, but what I did see was a prohibition on obscene and sexually explicit materials, which was rather vague, and I thought was kind of concerning when I saw my terms of service, because many people do use legal sexually explicit materials over the Internet, and I wondered if this move to block specific materials under this term was part of a larger motion to, say, block all sexually explicit materials. And I think this is very, very concerning because Verizon is the only broadband Internet that I have available at my location. So this is, to some extent, to me, a freedom of speech issue.
Eric Reid?
I'd be glad to respond to that. I think there are a couple of points important to be made here. First of all, I think Verizon actually has taken a leadership role in protecting the privacy of our customers and their communication. We've done this historically as a telephone company for more than 100 years, and as we've gotten into the Internet world, Verizon, I think, has been very active in resisting some of the calls that have been made for us to monitor things, control things, eliminate things, and so forth. I do not think you could find a case where Verizon is just kind of seen a picture of a pretty girl and suggested that that's pornography and we should therefore turn off the service to the customer who posted it. So I don't think we're overreaching on this. I think we're being very specific about child pornography. One of the things that we don't want to do, though, is to be sort of the police person here who looks over the material and makes the decision. That's why we're using the NCMEC list in regards to the website, and it's also why we have tried to be very even-handed but clear about the alt news groups and the others that are not among the Big Eight hierarchies. So, you know, we're trying to be crystal clear in terms of communicating to our customers what we do offer, and we're also trying not to be examining site by site, page by page, and making you know, our own judgments about the you know, veracity or legality of individual pages. And we certainly don't monitor our customers' communications across our networks to inspect them for illegal activity or whatever may be going on, even though it's entirely possible that there may be some people who are using our systems that way. We hope not, but we don't feel that it's our responsibility to monitor that for all the reasons that John laid out a few minutes ago.
Greg, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
And the follow-up for that would be, I guess, for all of you, and that is, I'll start with you, John Morris. There are concerns that this could be a first step, and that's what Greg's question was implying, that this could be a first step toward the Internet service providers acting as the police of the Internet. Is there a real risk of that?
Well, I do think there's a risk, and I'll acknowledge that Verizon, as Eric Rabe just said, has actually taken a stand and resisted in general the broad idea of making ISPs the policemen of the Internet. But there are calls by copyright owners, content owners, such as the MPAA and the recording industry. And there are calls both in Congress and state legislatures to make ISPs and other service providers traffic cops of the Internet. So, I mean, there are a lot of this temptation to view the ISP as a bottleneck that can really officiate over the Internet. But the job of the ISP is really simply to transfer traffic as quickly as possible from the end customer to the destination elsewhere on the Internet, and not to get in the middle and try to evaluate that traffic.
Eric Rabe, would you in general agree with that?
Yes, I absolutely would agree with that, and I think, you know, we're on record. We've been involved in a number of court cases that have been exercises in which somebody suggested we should monitor our customers' traffic for one kind of behavior or another, and we've resisted that. But as I say, this goes back a long way in our company history. You know, years ago there were concerns about telephone sex lines, and you know, there was a thought that we should eliminate those or prohibit people from doing that sort of thing. We resisted that at the time, and historically there have been all kinds of calls for us to you know, somehow be involved in a kind of a monitoring function. We don't think that's appropriate, and I think we've been fairly successful in resisting, and I'm sure we will continue to
resist it. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it also, John Sheehan.
Well, it's not the first time that we've certainly heard that type of an argument, and I think there's a lot of retorts that would come back in along the same lines of constitutional problems and free speech. I think what we need to do is obviously stay focused on what this piece is. I mean, what we're talking about, it's much more than just the term child pornography. You know, abroad, they talk about these types of images as sexually abusive images of children. These are crime scene photos, children who have been raped and sexually abused, who are re-victimized every time that image is traded and facilitated online. So if there's a way we can focus and bring that stuff off of the net, it's a good thing. And so, sure, a lot of people may look at that good thing and say, hey, does this have other applications? But that's why we have the due process and to be able to vet these types of things out. So, of course, that type of argument would be in place.
It's Eric Rabe. If I could just...
Please go ahead, Eric.
Because I think that's a very valid point that John's that's just been made here. If somebody brings to our attention illegal activity that's taking place using our systems, we have also historically cooperated with law enforcement to stop that. So, for example, somebody can't make a telephone call of a bomb threat, and if that happens, we will help the police find out who did that. So we're not abandoning our responsibility for protecting our customers and protecting the public in general, but that's in response to somebody coming to us with a specific complaint about a very specific situation. Similarly with copyright, if somebody comes to us with evidence that a Verizon customer may have been involved in some sort of copyright infringement, we'll take a look at that too. But that's quite different from sort of wholesale monitoring of the traffic to find these kinds of things.
Eric,
the final point that I would make is that we really are dealing in a whole different realm here when we're talking about child pornography from almost any other crime that you can imagine happening over our systems.
Eric Rabe, thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Eric Rabe is Senior Vice President for Media Relations with Verizon. John Sheehan, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Sheehan is Director of Exploited Children's Services with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. John Morris, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John is General Counsel and Director of the Internet Standards with the Technology and Policy Project of the Center for Democracy and Technology. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will be talking about the future of interplanetary travel and the likely involvement of robots. It's Tech Tuesday. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. You're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. Coming up at 2 o'clock today on Tell Me More, she's become the media's obsession, and her image and statements have sparked more controversy than anyone could have predicted. We'll hear from the magazine mavens about Michelle Obama. That's Tell Me More at 2 o'clock, right after the Kojo Namdi Show here on WAMU 88.5.
Hi, it's Kojo Namdi inviting you to take part in an online chat June 27th. It's your chance to ask me questions you've wanted to know, such as how we select show topics and guests that balance both sides of an issue, or why we don't take ourselves too seriously. Go to conversation.wamu.org and become part of our growing community of public radio fans. I'll see you online June 27th, beginning right after the Politics Hour at 1:15.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the Association of American Railroads, today's freight railroads are committed to working hard for the environment by moving a ton of freight 436 miles on just 1 gallon of fuel. More online at freightrailworks.org.
It's currently 77 degrees in Northwest Washington as the Kojo Namdi Show continues on WAMU 88.5 at 12:30.
Free-thinking robots and supercharged cyborgs may be a better fit for science fiction than space exploration for now. It's not like HAL from 2001, A Space Odyssey, is going to hit the market anytime soon, but could robotics actually be our space program's ticket to real intergalactic travel? Howard McCurdy and Roger Launius say that if we're set on exploring other planets and solar systems, we'll need robots that think like humans and humans with enhanced biological powers. With the pending retirement of the space shuttle, the government's got big decisions to make about the future of the space program and unmanned space missions. But will those decisions require us to completely rethink how we relate to machines? They join us in the studio. Howard McCurdy is chair of the Department of Public Affairs here at American University and co-author of the book Robots in Space, Technology, Evolution, and Interplanetary Travel. Howard McCurdy, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Roger Lonius, curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and co-author of Robots in Space. Roger Lonius, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
A lot of people are watching the Mars lander's every move, and many of those moves are commanded by programmers on Earth. The lander may be on the verge of a major discovery that there's ice on the Martian surface, but you envision unlocking a world of discoveries through more independent robotic systems. Why?
We're really interested in looking at the future of the space program beyond the next decade or so. We've been in the business for 50 years now. We're at a real turning point with the new administration coming in and reconsidering the vision for space exploration that was announced in 2004. So we just think it's a good time to assess whether or not the vision that launched the space program in the 1950s is an adequate one for the next 50 years. We think it's not. We think it's outmoded culturally and technologically.
You think that it's outmoded culturally and technology because it isn't looking at robots in the same way that you are looking at robots. Could you please explain?
One of the things that's happened is that our robotics capability with electronics and all of the things associated with that has expanded by unbelievable bounds since the beginning of the space age. When people envisioned spaceflight in the 1950s, before it had ever happened, they firmly believed that humans were going to be the centerpiece of that. Now we're finding that robots are very hardy, they're very capable, they're becoming more capable and more hardy all the time. It's time to relook at that old paradigm and suggest new ways in which we might explore.
Yeah, people like Wernher von Braun thought that we'd need astronauts to change the film in space telescopes. We've come a long way since that particular vision, but that's the vision that still drives the U.S. space program.
We typically think of robots as devices that are meant to serve their builders, like the droids in Star Wars. Are you suggesting that relationship is about to change?
I think the relationship is about to change. The classic concept of robot, especially as articulated by Isaac Asimov with his three laws, envision robots as human servants. Well, that's a bit technologically archaic as well, because we're getting to a point eventually that robots will need to have the capability to do self-corrections when they're on missions and not simply be like toys driven from a mission control center 23 million miles away. When that happens, of course, it raises fascinating questions that people have been exploring ever since Philip Dick wrote his famous book to Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. I mean, will they want to go on space missions, for example? But that's a little exotic. But certainly we're moving very rapidly in computer technology toward a point where we can have robotic missions that operate relatively autonomously.
Indeed, the human versus machine debate, you feel, is a false dichotomy, that it's a weak way of planning how we can explore the rest of our own solar system and what might lie beyond. Why is it a false dichotomy at this
point? Well, one of the things that's happened over the years is that you find people who are advocates of human spaceflight, and they're mostly focused on getting humanity off this planet in some form. That's a noble objective, and we're not in disagreement with that. There are others who are scientists who say, oh, well, our objective is to collect data, and it's not about sending people someplace else. And collecting data, a very efficient way to do that is with robots. That has been the debate for now more than 50 years associated with spaceflight. The suggestion that we make in the book is that we may need to relook at that in an entirely new way and possibly explore issues in which the creativeness and the problem-solving capabilities and the ingenuity of humans can be somehow merged with the hardiness and the robustness and the capabilities that robots are able to bring to the story.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on the future of space technology and the role of robotics and robots in it. You can call us at 800-433-8850. How much should our space program depend on robots to make new discoveries? 800-433-8850, or you can send email to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. Human spaceflight has always been a big part of the American space agenda. Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon is a source of national pride. What do you think it will take for policymakers in the U.S. to think twice about the role of human flight in the space program.
We should be clear about this, Kojo, that we're really in favor of moving humanity off the planet. We just want to look at it realistically. 50 years ago, when we were envisioning sending humans to Mars, we thought Mars was a fairly habitable planet. A lot of popular science writers believed that we'd find lichen or vegetation that was similar to the kind that you'd find in the Arctic tundra on Mars. Mars has turned out to be a much more inhospitable place than we thought it would be originally. So if we're really interested in having humanity move off the planet, you've got to ultimately ask the question, where are they going to move? And in what form are they going to move? It's interesting that NASA got into this business of thinking through what kind of humanity would move to other places in the 1960s and then dropped that as an issue because they felt it was just too exotic and they were preoccupied with sending humans on what were essentially camping trips to the moon. So if we're looking at the long-range future of the space program, it might not be that long-range if you're looking for 50 or 100 years out. And you've got to raise the question, well, if humans are really going to go to Mars and stay there for long periods of time, what kind of humans are they going to be? Because they can't just be humans in their classic form.
I hope my old Boy Scout leader is not listening to you right now. Human beings on camping trips to the moon. We're talking with Howard McCurdy. He is the chair of the Department of Public Affairs at American University and co-author of the book Robots in Space, Technology, Evolution, and Interplanetary Travel. Roger Lonius is a curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and co-author of Robots in Space. You mentioned that since we've been at this for 60 years, the technology has changed considerably. Are there already technological advances compelling enough to win Americans over on the potential of robotics?
Oh, I think so. There's no question about it. In terms of what robots have been able to do, especially in the last 15 years and certainly since the turn of the new century, it's been stunning accomplishments. Many of them are tied to the robotic probes that have gone to Mars, but also the Cassini spacecraft to Saturn and the Galileo spacecraft to Jupiter. All of them have returned enormously interesting findings and have been followed by the community in ways that no one had envisioned previously, where you've got especially 20-somethings who grew up essentially with a keyboard in their hands, who are tapping into this technology and are downloading images, who are watching very carefully as the little rovers on Mars, Spirit and Opportunity, carry out their mission now more than 4 years after their landing. And they're very excited by that in the same way that when I was a kid growing up in the 1960s and 70s was excited by the astronauts going to the moon on Apollo.
Howard, talk a little bit about the role that you feel interferometric telescopes can play in this.
We were very excited 50 years ago about the possibilities of exploring the early the inner solar system. We thought of Mars as an ancient Earth and even had science fiction stories about Martians invading the Earth. And we thought that Venus might be some sort of an Earth in development, maybe full of carbonous plants and the precursors of dinosaurs. Well, the inner solar systems turned out to be much more inhospitable than we thought it was. But that doesn't mean that the interest is lost. It simply means that we probably have to look further. We're developing new telescopes which have the capability of locating planets around nearby stars and then eventually interferometry telescopes that can capture images of those planets. And if they capture images of the planets, they can then do spectrographic studies which would allow us to look for the signatures of an Earth-like planet, free oxygen in the atmosphere, water vapor in the atmosphere, traces of carbon dioxide. This would identify what's in effect the new Mars. I think it would excite centuries of exploration and would certainly get young people interested in trying to understand whether or not these places harbor life. Now, that's an electromagnetic space program. It's kind of an interim space program. Eventually, I think, humanity will be interested in exploring these planets close up. And when we do that, we will have to confront a number of challenges. One is propulsion technology, but the other is who are you going to send? If you send humans, they're going to have to be as hardy as machines, and if you send machines, they're going to have to be as smart as humans.
It's as simple as that, folks. 800-433-8850. What do you think the immediate goals of our space program should be? Here is Mark in Reston, Virginia. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, you know, I think the immediate goal should be data collection. I really think this robot versus human debate is very similar to what we experienced 400 years ago when we were exploring North America. You know, it was very expensive and very risky, very dangerous to make that transatlantic crossing, where today we could do it in 5 hours. And I think what we should do is collect data at this current time, and maybe at some point in the future when the technology progresses, where space travel is less expensive and less risky, demands less of our resources, that would be the time to have human travel. So I know it's going to disappoint a lot of people who want to go to Mars next year, but I don't think it's the time.
Mark, thank you very much for your call. This allows me to raise the question, because the next president will have to make policy decisions fairly immediately that will determine how the next generation of space technologies are developed. I'd last like to ask each of you, what do you think a sound national space policy should look like, given the fact that our caller just expressed his idea of what it should look like?
Roger was just down at the Kennedy Space Center, so I'll let him answer this. Our greatest need right now is something to replace the space shuttle, some reliable, cost-effective method of moving from the Earth into low Earth orbit and then moving around in space. We're using the same technologies that we've been using for nearly 40 years. So hopefully there's some breakthroughs. Roger?
Yeah, one of the things that is fascinating about this whole question is that we haven't necessarily had a public debate, a national debate, on the issue of what we should be doing in space in the context of humans. And we have been bumping along with a human spaceflight program that goes back to 1961 with the first flight of Alan Shepard up through the present without any serious discussion of what it is we're trying to accomplish. Most people want to do that, generally speaking. The public is in favor of a human spaceflight program. They maybe think it costs too much. But there is a growing community of people like Mark who think that, well, it maybe really should be about robots and collecting information and data and learning more about that solar system and beyond, and ultimately planning for human expeditions elsewhere, but putting those pretty much on hold for the moment. Whether or not that actually happens in the new environment of a new administration is anyone's guess, but it's a good debate to have.
Indeed, you're looking for a full and open debate about that, but you say that politics may keep NASA from getting fully involved in that debate.
Oh, no question. I mean, NASA doesn't necessarily think that we need to have that debate. I'm sure there are some in the agency who do, but as an agency itself, it's quite happy with a human spaceflight program built around the model that has existed for now 40 years. And in many respects, that's an okay model. But we are at the point where there's decisions that have to be made about the future. We have bumped along with a space shuttle program that's been in existence since 1981 and has been flying, and it's had its good points and it's had its negatives. But on the whole, most people are reasonably happy with it. Now we have to retire that shuttle simply because it's just getting old and worn out, and we're at the point, like you are with a car, where you can put more money into it or you can finally bite the bullet and go down to the dealer and say, okay, I've got to get something else. And we're kind of at that point with the shuttle. So what's it going to be? That then raises the debate that you should be discussing in terms of humans.
Howard McCurdy, do you yet have a sense for where NASA would be likely to go under either of the two presidential candidates, McCain or Obama?
I can tell you what's common between the two presidential candidates. I think they're both committed to replacing the shuttle with some sort of launch vehicle. Now, what kind of launch vehicle that is could get redebated. But clearly we're going to retire the shuttle in 2010, and by 2016 or so there will be some sort of new launch vehicle. But what it is and how fast it goes and how far it can go, I think, are really open to question. And then the other part of that that's open to question is where does it go immediately? I think if John McCain is elected president, he will probably continue the current policy of trying to land Americans on the moon by 2020. And if Barack Obama is elected, I get the sense that he would like to move ahead with the launch vehicle program, but he would leave open the question of where that launch vehicle would go. We might just work on the space station for the next decade. You know, we've invested over $60 billion in 30 years in constructing the space station, and so he might have an inclination to say, no, let's take advantage of that now that the assembly is complete. So focus on low Earth orbit. But in either case, we need a method of moving about the solar system that's more effective than the one we've got right
and
now.
Senator McCain has indicated that, yes, he would like to put a man on Mars. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, if you have already called, stay on the line. We'll get to your call. If not, we still have lines open at 800 833-8850, or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up at 1, getting the most bang for your travel buck during tight economic times, plus a local tradition inspired by the West Indies inside D.C.'s Caribbean Carnival. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
On Tell Me More, we tell you more on matters ranging from personal finance...
I hope you're able to save more and spend more wisely.
To international affairs.
Although the issues in Zimbabwe are different to those in Kenya, people are worried that there may be violence.
To matters of faith.
The fundamentalists that I grew up with, they weren't interested in world domination. They just wanted to be left alone.
And of course, there's much more. So join us on Tell Me More from NPR News.
And on today's show, we'll hear about Michelle Obama from the magazine Mavens. That's Tell Me More, coming up at 2 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the Sanju K. Bansal Foundation, dedicated to helping people help themselves through improved access to information.
Sunny skies this afternoon, highs in the mid-80s. It's 77 degrees at 12:47 as the Kojo Namdi Show continues.
Welcome back. It's Tech Tuesday. We're discussing the future of space technology with Roger Lonius and Howard McCurdy. They are co-authors of the book Robots in Space, Technology, Evolution, and Interplanetary Travel. Roger Lonius is a curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. Howard McCurdy is chair of the Department of Public Affairs at American University. Gentlemen, allow me to go directly to the telephones. Here is Steve, who is on Route 50 in Virginia. Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kojo. I just had a comment and with regards to moving people from this planet to other planets. I think it's a great idea, especially if I'm one of the few that's left on this particular planet. and I think it's just interesting and ironic to me. I think Kurt Vonnegut is probably laughing hysterically, you know, about the idea of calling other planets, of course they are, for our life. They're inhospitable, but I think this planet is becoming rapidly more inhospitable, and it seems we ought to kind of think about cleaning up this one or not further trashing this planet before we go and leave detritus on others. That's my comment. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your call. Care to respond to that, Roger Lonius?
Certainly, certainly. Steve makes a good point, and there's a couple of pieces to it that are very important. The first one is, if we are undertaking migration to some other place at some point in the future, the real question is, who goes and who stays?
Steve seems to think his pesky neighbor should be the first to go.
And I've got a list like that as well. But nonetheless, it would be a very small community of humans who would make a trip like that, I'm sure. And who gets to decide those things? Nobody has even thought about that in any serious manner. His call for preservation of this planet is a very important one and a good one. And there's a lot of effort in terms of space technology to try to understand that more effectively as well.
Here's an email we got from Alan, who says, when NASA was created, one of its purposes was to develop advanced technologies. However, much of the current Constellation program is relying on off-the-shelf technologies and systems. Do you believe that NASA is adequately investing in advanced technologies that would enable greater advances to both robotic and human exploration? If NASA isn't investing in advanced technologies, then who is? Allow me to add to what Alan asked in his first question. The knowledge that NASA is in the process of developing a new spacecraft to replace the shuttle, what do you make of these early plans, and are they in accordance with what our emailer Alan suggests NASA needs to be doing?
I think Alan's right on target. He's pointing out one of the difficulties that afflicts the current Project Constellation, and that is that it has to be done within a fixed NASA budget of $16 to $17 billion a year, which is to say it has to be done inexpensively. Now, that's a good thing, However, if you convert that into the technology that's being used to develop the rocketry, it's a fairly conventional technology which allows us to keep the price down, which means that we still got 9-month trips to Mars. It would be much more effective if we had rocketry that would allow us to make trips to Mars and back in a single pass in 9 months for the whole round trip, rather than a 3-year round trip that would involve a 9-month voyage out and a 7 to 8 month voyage back, where you have to keep people alive and functioning for 3 years. We can't keep the space station running for 6 months without resupply from the Earth. So this is real challenging. I'd like to see investment in new rocketry and new technology. As to where some of this work is going on, I'd point out that at least in robotics, a lot of it's going on in the Defense Department. Watch the Great Mojave Robot Race that DARPA is organizing. By 2016, 1/3 of all military vehicles will supposedly be driven by robots. So that they're making tremendous advances in that area, and I would suggest that as probably the robots can do as good a job as many drivers on the Beltway.
Here we got an email from Dutch and Chevy Chase, which I'm going to divide in two parts. The first being, Dutch writes, I'm curious about how robotics can improve human performance.
Well, one of the things that we're doing right now with robots and allowing them to assist humans in exploration is basically extending our presence to another location. The robots that are on Mars, the robots that are in orbit around Mars or other places, are under human control, and they are not autonomous at all. So there's an extension that takes place there, and we're able to use them in that way. One of the things that we suggest in the book is that there's going to have to be an autonomy that the robots are going to have to develop, especially if we start talking about extrasolar exploration and moving beyond the places that we can go in this solar system.
Howard McCurdy, if robots become capable of thinking for themselves, and I suspect more importantly of reproducing, there's a certain segment of the public that I suspect that will not sit very well with. What is your view?
Well, that's the Frankenstein side of robotics that Isaac Asimov used to rail against. But, you know, the original concept of robotics is a Czechoslovakian concept, and the play involved robots that were in the business of manufacturing other robots. Isaac Asimov has that in a number of his stories, including the early robot story, that they're in the business of manufacturing each other. And then the Blade Runner movie, where the robots come back to Earth, they're prohibited from being on the Earth because they're considered too dangerous on Earth, and so they're confined to Mars. So there's a lot of concern, especially in the California communities where people are working on this, that if the robots get smart enough, they won't want to take orders from us anymore. But it's an interesting thought as to, you know, we don't tell these robots that they're on one-way trips to Mars.
They're on suicide missions, and Spirit and Opportunity on Mars are not coming home. We did not ask. They did not have informed consent in this.
That's another debate for another time. Here is Vijay in Kensington, Maryland. Vijay, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Can you all hear?
You hear you very well.
Yeah, well, the thing that came to my mind is, with all this planning for all these long-distance missions, our present-day technology limits us to a certain amount of range because we can only carry so much fuel up as well as to come down and land safely. We have to develop a technology which will make it possible for us to generate fuel from something we find out there. So that's something which we have to bear in mind. Otherwise, we cannot travel long distances that you all are talking about now. Do you agree with me on that?
Howard McCurdy.
There are two fascinating proposals that NASA has considered off and on. You can probably catch them on their websites. I don't think they erase them. One is the idea of making rocket fuel on the moon. If there is, in fact, water ice on the moon, you can make the constituents necessary to fuel hydrogen-powered engines from the moon. And that reduces the gravitational requirements of moving the fuel into orbit. Other ideas are even more exotic. Marshall Space Flight Center for some years did experiments that actually actual experiments that showed spacecraft being driven into orbit on the tops of laser beams so that the spacecraft did not carry their own propulsion with them. It was beamed to them from the ground. And they actually built a few models, and you could get them a couple feet off the surface of the Earth, but not at Earth orbit.
Actual experiments.
So in other words, Vijay, there are things that can be done in order to accomplish that. Vijay, thank you very much for your call. Here now is Paul in Leesburg, Virginia. Paul, your turn.
Yeah, hi, Kojo. Great show here.
Thank you.
Sort of a political question. You know, the Russians have put a flag at the North Pole, claiming it as part of their territory with the global warming possibly opening up things. And I'm wondering, the Chinese now are looking to put a man on Mars. The question is robotics versus man exploration. Do we think about what other nations are doing and what happens if we're heavy duty in robotics and then other nations, be it India, China, or other powers, are actively exploring with manned missions? I don't know what this means, and I don't have any answers. I don't have any thoughts, but you have a great panel there, and I'd be curious what their responses are, and I'll take my answer.
Oh, yeah, they know what it takes to get our competitive juices flowing. Here's Howard McCurdy.
Yeah, Wernher von Braun used to ask, how do you milk the golden cow? And that was the question. How do you get governments to spend money on space when they have other priorities? And one of the ways you do that is you engage in international competition with the Russians in the 1960s, and now the Chinese are developing Apollo-style capability. I suspect that within a few years that they will make a circumlunar voyage, and that will excite a lot of people to want to put Americans on the moon. And I think we'll do that.
On Mars, that is.
Well, us first on the moon.
Oh, on the moon.
The Chinese to the moon. I don't think they have the capability to go to Mars, but who knows what they might try once they get that capability. But for reasons of national prestige, nations may still engage in human exploration of the inner solar system. But what Roger and I are arguing is that in the long run, this is probably not going to result in the achievement of the visions, the colonization of Mars that people thought it would result in when we started this 50 years ago.
We were talking about the future of space technology. We've just about run out of time. Howard McCurdy is co-author of the book Robots in Space, Technology, Evolution, and Interplanetary Travel. He is chair of the Department of Public Affairs at American University. Roger Launius, co-author of the book, is a curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, it's been 6 months since the deaths of four girls allegedly at the hands of their mother sent shockwaves through Washington, D.C. We explore whether the outrage has sparked real changes in the social safety net, plus history behind the headlines. 4 decades after Metro was first envisioned, a look at shifting expectations for a modern transportation system. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU.